I feel like this is going to be really discouraging to people who might want to start a podcast. And I was like, I'm okay with that.
Hello, Radio Survivor listeners. Please excuse this interruption of the beginning of the program. I'm Eric Klein, one of your host producers, jumping on at the beginning of the episode to justify its length. What happened is that we had the opportunity to meet and interview an indie radio producer hero of mine, Julie Sabatier, and she detailed for us her near decade-long odyssey to make and distribute her own dream show her own way.
No one knew what a podcast was in 2006. I remember on the website it was like, it's sort of like a magazine. You subscribe and it comes to you.
Radio nerd confession, I used to be jealous of Julie Sabatier and her show's small but legitimate success. But I am jealous no longer, now that I have learned the details of everything she did to make her show into what it was, the obstacles she cleared from her path, the money she raised for everyone but herself.
I jumped at the chance to create a public radio show for free and raise money by myself to pay other people to help me. And, you know, it seemed like a good idea at the time.
So you are either an indie radio producer yourself, or you're an enormous fan of podcasts, or whoever you are, this interview that you're about to hear is how the sausage gets made. This is how one of the elite podcasts on one of the premier podcasting networks came into existence, and detailed here in today's episode, the creator of that show explains why she's shutting it down. And it's complicated.
I had been sort of thinking about this, and I'd been wrestling with it, and I'd been, you know, weighing the pros and cons.
It's a long story. A long story I find really compelling. Julie is having a baby, and having a baby made her decide to shut down her show, but she is not shutting down her show because she is having a baby. See, I told you it's complicated.
It was an economic problem. Like, I mean, it's really important to me that people not just say, okay, well, Julie decided to be a mom, so she's not going to do this podcast anymore, because it's not that simple. It's really a narrative that is much more universal across podcasting.
Come with us into the weeds. We're talking about crowdfunding, your independently produced podcast. What did you learn about crowdfunding radio?
I learned that I never want to do it again. I did not sign up to be an entrepreneur.
But first, there's more. Jennifer Waits gets a peek at the treasure vaults of chaos, the college radio station at Evergreen in Olympia, Washington.
One of these rooms where you want to spend hours in there, but, you know, people are on a timeline, so it's like, how much can I see and take pictures of before I have to scurry out of this magical room?
And at the end of the program, Matthew Lassar, don't miss it, he drills down into the unique history, the radio moment when card-carrying communists composed and sang a ode to American freedom and democracy. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Radio Survivor. My name is Paul Riespendel, and I'm one of your hosts.
My name is Eric Klein. I am the co-host of Radio Survivor.
And, well, we've got an exciting show today, I think.
I am excited about today's guest.
Yes, we'll be having in Julie Sabatier, who is a longtime radio producer and podcaster, most recently of the show called Rendered on the Maximum Fun Podcast Network, formerly known as Destination DIY. And she's also a full-time radio producer with Oregon Public Broadcasting.
Yeah, I think Julie Sabatier and I are former coworkers, although I'm going to have to confirm that when she gets here. I think she has some roots at FSRN, Free Speech Radio News. And she also started off in Portland at KBOO, KBOO, a Pacifica affiliate. So she has a lot of experience in lots of kinds of radio, and a great guest for our show.
Yes, lots of great things. And of course, we'll hear from Jennifer Waits with College Radio Watch a little later in the show. And Matthew, we'll close out the proceedings with Lassar's letter on radio. And I don't know if I have much follow-up from our last show. I had a pretty good rant. I haven't really heard any comments on it so far.
It's funny because your rant, which I participated in about your, you know, in case people didn't hear it, it was about why you podcast. And if people are podcasting to try to make an income off of their podcasts and it's not happening for them, perhaps taking their toys and going home is not necessarily the right reaction. That was the gist.
No, not quite.
Or maybe they should.
No, well, I mean, more than no. The gist was rather just to try and figure out why that's happening. I mean, that's so much. It's more the rant was about the sort of sense of entitlement that if I go and I, you know, buy all the mics, get all the toys and produce a very nice sounding podcast, that I am sort of entitled to some level of success, usually thought of as monetary success, but it could be success in terms of listenership or anything. And right. Sort of encouraging people to set their expectations reasonably and not go into it thinking, I've put in all this time, I'm deserving of this.
Rather, thousands upon thousands of listeners will flock right. to my content.
And to also feel lucky that you have any listeners at all.
Right.
I think that was the ended up being the big point, is to encourage people to be gracious and respectful and thankful for anyone who chooses to download and listen to their show.
Yeah, and I was able to spread that message to a good friend of mine who has a wonderful podcast I feel like I should plug it now, but
yeah,
that was
ahead.
Not my intention.
Go ahead and
it's
plug
called
it.
Doomtown, and they're producing that program out of Los Angeles, and it's two friends of mine that how do I want to put it? It's profane. It's two men talking about things that men talk about when they drink things. They are both friends of each other, so they tease each other a lot, and then they have guests. It doesn't have a huge audience, and they would like it to have a larger audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of give my friend a pep talk
yeah.
about doing the work. And in my mind, that show in particular, which is reminiscent of how we do this show in a way, it's also, yes, you want thousands of listeners, but it's also about the relationships of the people in the room doing the recording.
Right,
and
right.
And that my friendship with you that develops around this work is just as important to me as thousands and thousands of listeners.
No, I agree. I think that's exactly right. And I think that's how a lot of very successful podcasts kind of came to be. It was around relationships, and it was around, you know, sometimes the host's relationships together, mm-hmm. or a host and producer, people who really enjoyed working together and found podcasting to be a venue for working, for doing that,
right.
essentially, where maybe they were more unfettered or there were more opportunities. They didn't have to rely on other people getting in the way or other people saying yes. Gatekeepers in order to do it. I think that's a really smart, astute observation there about this medium.
It came up because I listened to another very strange podcast called The Worst Idea of All Time.
Yes.
And The Worst Idea of All Time is where two gentlemen, young men who are stand-up comedians in New Zealand, developed this podcast around the premise that they would watch a terrible movie every week over and over and over again. In this case, Grown Ups 2. But in that first episode that I listened to, the one man says to the other man, I just wanted to be your friend. And so that's why I came up with this stupid idea. And I'm so glad we're doing it, because it gives us a chance to hang out. And that's very silly. But it also made me realize that relationship that they were building right before our very ears was the only reason to listen to this terrible idea of a show. It was mm-hmm. that friendship that they had surrounding the terrible ordeal that they'd subjected themselves to by watching a horrible movie off mic. They watch the bad movie and then they get on mic to discuss. And that silly, silly show was what gave me that insight into podcasts.
And that gets, I mean, you get my mind thinking about all these different podcasts that are, you know, are fairly popular, and how many of them really boil down to that chemistry. And I mean, that's true of like television talk shows. It's often true of, you know, commercial radio shows or even some public radio shows. Although there's fewer and fewer public radio shows where there's a lot of host interaction, really.
Yeah. I think Radiolab might be the winner right
yeah,
there.
Car Talk.
Car Talk, of course, Car Talk. I'm not going to do that.
I just blew out the mics on that one. But I think that so much of the time you know, for television and for more commercial media or mainstream commercial media, that chemistry is a little bit contrived, meaning they go and try to find a co-host or try and find that person to work with you, but it's not necessarily organic. It's not like your pals. It's not like your friends in the same way that I think like a slight gab fest to some extent, you get the sense that those folks are their colleagues, yeah. but in that way, they're pals, or in the way of which, you know, in a lot of comedy podcasts, those are folks who really like each other and like to work with each other in addition to wanting, you know, to make a show. And that, I think that's maybe what a lot of people like about podcasting and what a lot of people even like about college radio, the best college radio often, or some of the best community radio are shows that friends or people, you know, put together, and it's not contrived because it's a rare community station where there's this surplus of talent, so to speak, where they can say, well, why don't we put those two in the studio together and see how it works up? It tends to be more like, well, so-and-so knows so-and-so, she knows this person, mm-hmm. and she brings this other person in, and they end up working together on the show. And I can remember many community radio shows that I really liked, principally because of the hosts' chemistry, even if sometimes I wasn't crazy about maybe the music they played or even their topic of discussion, but their chemistry is what made the show worth listening to, yeah. in those pre-podcasting days.
This reminds me of a loose thread that I wanted to bring up on the show maybe a month ago and forgot. The Dust Brothers, who are the producers of the Beastie Boys album Paul's Boutique, which we mentioned on the show because KEXP did this fantastic 12-hour broadcast of every song sampled by the Dust Brothers in that Beastie Boys album that they produced. And that was just a fun idea for a radio program, a radio event. I learned later, well, actually, I learned by actually listening to that show instead of just talking about it, that the Dust Brothers were radio hosts, and they had a college radio show in Los Angeles in the 80s that they claim, and I believe them, was the first hip-hop show of its kind in the region. And so that's how that's the first music that they produced was the interstitial bump music and promos.
Oh, okay.
They made their own hip-hop beats to do their own stuff for
where
radio.
Where they had access to, it's a radio studio, but it's a studio. So, and it was the 80s, so they definitely had at least two turntables, and then they probably had loop cart machines, which could be used to trigger samples, wow. or trigger things, right? Even if you didn't have all the technology. And then you probably even had a reel-to-reel machine where they could cut things up and do cut and paste sort of things, like, I mean, basically like Negative Land in that way. But they would have been able to do it on the beat. And I knew when I was in college radio, I knew some of our hip hop DJs then. So this is late 80s, early 90s, mm-hmm. and who didn't do anything quite Dust Brothers level. But, you know, I mean, they were using these turntables, which at the time they were from the 60s. The broadcast turntables looked nothing like a Technics 1200. And yet were really great at beat matching. Mm-hmm. Like I'd watch them, and they would do it with their thumbs, like slowing the record down and getting it just right, getting the next one come in, and that's two hands going, but really create amazing beats in a studio not remotely set up like a club or even a deck for a party. So I think that's a great thing to bring in. By the way, this is episode number 9.
Okay.
People who are keeping score at home, where we talked about KEXP's special broadcast about Paul's Boutique.
Which is now the archive has been taken down. Right.
Oh,
you can't hear it unless you email me.
But you can see the playlist.
Yes, and you can also listen to the interview that I'm referencing. So actually we could put a link to it.
Yeah,
we buried the lead, Paul. We buried the lead. One of the reasons why we are having Julie Sabatier in studio with us momentarily is that she has retired her podcast.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so we'll get a statement from her.
Yes.
Because I don't want to put words in her mouth. There were many reasons.
Right. Exactly.
We
will find out shortly. But yeah, you know, it's just this opportunity at the top of the show here. I'm glad we're taking it to talk a little bit about positively and about some of these things. This je ne sais quoi, if you will, of podcasting and great radio. I mean, we get to it occasionally. We graze past it occasionally. But, you know, that we sort of, a lot of us seem to be on the same page about it, whether you're a podcast fan or you're a radio fan. And because I think it goes equally for some great like commercial radio talk shows, like, or even great, you know, if you think about Howard Stern, it's hard to think of the Howard Stern Show without Robin Quivers, without Baba Booey, without the sort of cadre of people, the team he built up around him, who seemed to genuinely like each other, or at least have genuine relationships of sorts, even outside the studio, in addition to what they would do every morning, and how shows like that bring you in to that environment, how you kind of feel like they are your friends.
No, that's the conceit, at least, of every morning zoo, is that they're having a good time together. Even though I mostly think they're faking.
Right. Well,
being loud.
I think that was sort of, at least when I was like a teenager listening to Howard Stern in like the 80s, it was how he put the lie to that conceit, because he was so, in a lot of ways, there was less conceit to his show. Mm-hmm. He was the one who burped on air. He didn't do the time checks. He wouldn't do all the things you were supposed to do. He would talk too much on FM radio. Because remember, Morning Zoo, you would still play records. Right, you were still kind of cramming in some music and bits in between, and he would put all of that aside and had the long form discussions about at the time nothing. I mean, really, Howard Stern in my view is at least one precursor to modern podcasting in that way, right? Because aside from maybe like Bob Fass late or overnights on like WBAI or freeform radio stations or college stations, the idea that you would have on a mainstream commercial station a sort of real freeform, untethered conversation about whatever, which might include guests and might include other things, was a new idea. And yet that sort of is what we have in podcasting, some better than others, of course.
It's interesting that Howard Stern didn't end up on podcasts.
Yeah, and he slags podcasts.
He squeaked, well, because he'd like to make more money.
Indeed.
He squeaked right into that satellite radio world.
All right. Well, why don't we take a break here, and why don't we check in with Jennifer and College Radio Watch.
Hey, Paul. I have another college radio tour that I want to share with you this week. I'm getting caught up on all of my station visits, and back this summer, back about a month ago, I did a road trip through the Pacific Northwest when I got to see you live in person in your home studio. And during that trip, I saw a few radio stations, including Chaos FM, which is KAOS FM, at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. And it's a station that I've wanted to visit for a long time because I've known some people that have been there, and also it has kind of adventurous, intriguing, freeform programming. And it's also an interesting hybrid because it's a college radio station that also has a lot of community members that are part of the station. So I eagerly drove to campus on August 5th to check out Chaos.
I mean, I've certainly heard of Chaos. I think it's pretty well known in community radio circles. And in a lot of ways, I think people forget that it's a college station, too. So it seems to be a pretty functional hybrid, though. It seems to be that it works pretty well as both a community and college station there.
Yeah. So they have students involved with leadership positions at the station. They also have two full-time staff members. So students are very involved with running the place, but there's also a very large contingent of non-students who are on the air at the station. And yeah, it seems like a very well-oiled machine. They've been around for more than 40 years and have pretty impressive digs in the basement of the Student Activities Building. I think that the space they're in now was remodeled with the station in mind. So they've got spaces that have been designed exactly for the way they want to use them. So I was impressed. They have a live performance room that even had a curtain that you could pull back and forth for sound dampening. And I'm not sure I've seen that at many stations.
Wow.
So that was pretty cool. So it seems like they have support from the school too, and that they were able to remodel this space that has multiple production studios, a large space for the CD library, and then other little hidden spaces like a vinyl vault that was truly magical, that had, you know, lots of interesting records. I saw a Lily Tomlin comedy album perched on top of a shelf, and Husker Du, and, you know, one of these rooms where you want to spend hours in there, but, you know, people were on a timeline. So it's like, ah, how much can I see and take pictures of before I have to scurry out of this magical room?
Right. And you had a chance to talk with some of the folks there at Chaos.
Yeah. So I met up with Morgan Jaffe, and she's one of the two full-time staff members there. She's actually in charge of operations and training. So she toured me around and we chatted a bit about the station. And one of the first things I asked her was, what makes Chaos unique?
What makes Chaos unique is how much freedom we have with our programming and how much freedom we allow for our DJs. And I love how much we focus on media and music and news and all of that that might not necessarily get a voice in mainstream radio or mainstream media at all. The fact that we have native shows and world shows and Celtic and rock and hip-hop and electronic and dance and all these other subgenres and non-genres and all of that, I think it really makes for an interesting listen for all of our fans.
So it's cool when you look through the library at Chaos, you can see genre labels for all of these different genres that Morgan is talking about. So I saw signs for experimental and native, jazz, just a really wide diversity of music programming there. And then she told me about another show that I was trying to find out. I'm always interested to hear if stations have programming that's unique, programming that's different from any other station, or weird. Are there any weird shows? And a show that came to mind for her was a children's show that they air.
On Sundays, we have Coddleston Pie, which I really love. It's a children's show, but I love the host. Her name's Melissa Souther, and she goes by Miss Melissa on air. And she'll have on that anything from, what she called, like, instead of hip-hop, it's kid-hop. And instead of indie, it's kindy. So she'll just play a bunch of different stuff. I love listening to that. I mean, I think it's technically for kids, but I have a great time listening to it. I don't care.
Jennifer, in your travels, have you encountered much children's programming, children's-oriented programming on college stations or even community stations?
Yeah, here and there. I would say I've heard of a handful of children's shows, and I went to one station that had shows that actually involved kids from the local community, so kids were part of the production of the show. So it's not completely unusual, but a rarity, I would say, and a welcome addition to the lineup to have something like that. And as a parent, you know, a lot of children's oriented radio programming is kind of lowest common denominator, so it's always cool to hear about something that might be more interesting to indie music lovers.
So it's not Radio Disney, is what you're saying?
Yeah, probably not.
You know,
probably not.
So something occurs to me, you know, having listened to this interview and listening to your previous interviews, when stations talk about how they're unique, they actually say the same things as other college and community stations most of the time, you know, so which is interesting for me as, you know, hearing them and as somebody who is such an enthusiast of community and college radio, because I feel like, well, that isn't so unique. But I realize they're probably not thinking in their head, this is what makes Chaos stand out compared to another college station or KFJC or something. They're thinking, what makes Chaos stand out from all the other stations in the Olympia, Washington region? Do you think that's about right?
Yeah, I think it is. And I think also, I mean, I don't think this is the case at Chaos necessarily, but I think generally college radio stations think of themselves as sort of being in a bubble. And so often you'll see on radio station websites, you know, we're one of the last, insert phrase here, like, you know, we're one of the last freeform stations in the country, you know. And so I think a lot of stations think that, you know, they're one of a handful of stations doing programming that is controlled by DJs, that has a freeform perspective. And there are a lot more stations doing this maybe than most stations realize. So yeah, I think they're probably thinking of themselves in relation to commercial radio or mainstream public radio, rather than the broader community of like-minded college and community radio stations.
And I think that's fair, because in any given city, they may be the only station, and they're far outnumbered by public stations and Christian non-commercial stations and commercial stations. And often you do have to look a lot harder to find the eclectic freeform college station. And the stations aren't always well networked together either. I mean, that's part of why we do what we do, is so that people know about these stations, because we realize that they're criminally underrepresented and unknown. So it was just an observation I had, and not really a criticism. And I just kind of wanted to kind of get your feedback on it. But I understand that.
Oh yeah, yeah. I've noticed, Paul. I've noticed the same thing exactly. Because I think I'm always expecting, sometimes I do get an answer about maybe a show that's really different from another station. And so sometimes I'm looking for that, something I've never heard of before.
And it probably exists. Yeah. And it probably exists. But I do understand it seems like that chaos probably stands apart from some stations, because they sort of are trying to institutionalize their eclecticism and being outside the mainstream. Is that true?
Well, yeah. They were one of the first stations to have an independent music policy, which dates back to the 1970s. So they have a rule of sorts where DJs are supposed to play 80% independent music on their shows. And also there's a dedication to local music as well. And local is defined differently by each person that you ask. But this has been an important part of the station, is that they're supporting independent artists that are on independent labels and that are distributed by independent labels.
Chaos has been around since 1973. And that policy actually started when Chaos started. Evergreen itself has always been a school that is for, you know, individuals who want to experience maybe what isn't necessarily mainstream. And it really worked out well for Chaos, because by focusing on all that independent music, I mean, Olympia has a really great music scene, you know, and that also is very true for Evergreen. So I think with the independent music policy and that 80-20 music policy, we're really just trying to focus on having all those sounds that you wouldn't hear anywhere else. It really came about because we wanted a station for listeners and not for ads, and really an opportunity for our DJs to play and to share their music. It's really about sharing here.
And if I'm not incorrect, Olympia, Washington, where Evergreen and Chaos is, I mean, that was the site of a lot of music that became very influential in the 1990s. I think did Nirvana get their start in Olympia, and a lot of the Riot Girl bands get their start in Olympia?
Yeah, there's definitely a deep connection with punk rock and indie rock from that era. In the mid-90s, I went to this music festival in Olympia called Yo-Yo A Go-Go, and it was like a who's who of up-and-coming bands, and Beck was even there playing at that festival, along with a lot of punk bands and Riot Girl bands. And it was definitely a big place for the Riot Girl scene and, you know, that sort of third-wave pragmatic feminism that sprung from the punk rock scene and women wanting to have kind of their own voice in it. So it's a very active artistic community, and the station is an extension of all of that.
That's great. And in addition to it being a college station, you mentioned at the top that it's also a community radio station. And so Chaos is also involved with community radio, within the sort of the larger kind of community radio movement in the U.S., correct?
Yeah. And right before my visit, they actually – Chaos hosted the Olympia Summit in collaboration with the National Federation of Community Broadcasters, which we also refer to as NFCB. So they had a big event at the station, and And Morgan, talk to me a bit about that.
We actually just hosted a conference for NFCB here on August 23rd through the 25th. So we had over 100 people come. It was awesome. I've been to conferences before, but I've never gone to go to a strictly radio conference over all types of media, and it was so nice having all those stations at the same time. And, you know, we had stations. It was a summit, a regional summit that NFCB hosted, and that we worked with them to create. But it had stations anywhere from Washington State and Oregon and California. We also had some people come out from Wisconsin and Boston and, Alaska, I guess, gets kind of grouped into Pacific Northwest. But we had people from all over come. So that was, I think that was perfect for collaboration. And, it just happened, what's today? Like a week and a half ago or something like that. So I'm hoping to continue to collaborate, but we do already collaborate a lot with stations like KPLU and KBOO. And well, even more than that, I'm still learning all the acronyms because I'm new to the West Coast. We really love collaborating with other stations.
So for the NFCB Summit, were there a lot of college stations that came, or was it mostly community stations?
It was mostly community stations, but we did have some stations that, like us, are a community station that just so happens to be on a college campus and involve college students a lot. I'm trying to think. I don't think any of the stations were strictly college, though.
And what kinds of things did you do at the summit? Did you have workshops in the station?
Yeah. It started on Thursday night. So on Thursday, we had a station tour so people could come and check out Chaos and see where we were. And then after that, we had a concert, actually, with Anna Gordon, who's a local Olympian folk musician, and also Naomi Watra, who is from Seattle and is also another wonderful local musician. And that was Thursday. And then on Friday, we had two keynote speakers. We had workshops in the afternoon on programming and development. And we also, that evening, as well as other types of workshops. And that evening, we went down, and everyone was invited to the Olympia Film Society, and we did a double feature. The first film was Sex and Broadcasting, and Kevin Friedman was actually here, which was awesome. He led one of the workshops in the afternoon.
Oh, Ken Friedman from WFMU.
Yeah, Ken Friedman was here, and he hosted a workshop in the afternoon, and then he and the director did a question and answer section after that, and then we showed for the second film Where the DJs Roam, which is about, I'm blanking on which station, but a station in Montana. And then on Saturday we had a regional meeting so that we could plan on how to continue working together.
So yeah, it was cool to hear that Chaos had hosted over 100 people for the NFCB summit, and it sounds like there could be a lot of interesting collaborations to come out of that since they met people from so many different stations. So it was great to hear about how they're connected with the broader radio community.
Yeah, it sounds like that could be very useful for the station, obviously, but also for the students to have some more exposure to other like-minded stations in the region and help them understand that, they're part of a movement of sorts and they're part of a different sector of radio. But I think that also helps to understand that they're not alone, that there are other opportunities perhaps after they graduate, if they move beyond the beautiful forest of Olympia, and that there are other ways to do radio beyond just what they see around them.
Yeah, I think it's a great opportunity and probably really inspiring to see films about radio, because they had some films that they showed at the summit and lots of different workshops and inspirational speakers like Ken Friedman from WFMU. So I'm sure it was a rare opportunity for students at at Evergreen to really be exposed to this broader world of community radio. So when I saw you in Portland, Paul, we were talking about the radio station tours I was trying to do on my family vacation, and you know, and I dragged my family along, which includes my 9-year-old daughter. And by the end of the trip, she was actually getting excited about radio station field trips because I let her handle the microphone and ask some questions. So I thought we'd end by giving her another moment in the spotlight.
What do you love about college radio?
That's a very good question. I love that you get to learn how to do radio, but in a really cool environment where you still get to make real radio. It's not one or the other. It's this really cool experiment of just music and interviews and news. So I love that we have a bunch of student staff here at Chaos, and that not only are they learning a lot for after college, but we couldn't do it without them, and I know that for sure.
So that was just Morgan Jaffe, who is the training and operations manager at Chaos at Evergreen State College in Olympia, and she was being interviewed by my daughter, Miss B.
That's great. Thanks for sharing your tour of Chaos. Where can people learn more? Maybe tune in and listen to the station now that they've learned a bit about it.
Yeah, so chaosradio.org is the website. And again, Chaos is K-A-O-S. So kaosradio.org. And if you're in Olympia, it's 89.3 FM.
Great. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Paul.
That was College Radio Watch with Jennifer Waits. All of the information from that segment will be on the show notes page. And you can also learn more about college radio with Jennifer's weekly column at radiosurvivor.com. Up next, we're going to be talking with podcast producer and radio professional, Julie Sabatier.
Hi, I'm Julie Sabatier, host of Rendered. It's a show about making meaning and breaking rules. We're answering important questions like, can you build a spacesuit in your living room?
I went to my brother's place in Beaverton, and he has a swimming pool, and I pressurized the suit and sat down there underwater for about 10 minutes. The thing that I had built was supporting my life. That felt really good.
What does it sound like when you play a polka record through a styrofoam cup? And what happens when an airport carpet gains a cult following?
Oh my goodness, the carpet has an Instagram.
Check out Rendered now at MaximumFun.org or wherever you like to listen to podcasts.
Well, we're joined in studio, in Paul's home studio, with Julie Sabatier, who is, her day job is a producer with Oregon Public Broadcasting, OPB's Think Out Loud program, which airs every day at noon here in Portland. But we invited Julie to come into the studio because she has been the producer of a podcast with two names. You've made it difficult, Julie, by renaming it. That's okay. It's Destination DIY was its original name, and then it was renamed to Rendered. So welcome, Julie.
Thank you. And actually, it has had three names in its many iterations. It started as a show called DIY Portland on KABU, and then it was Destination DIY, and then recently changed to Rendered.
Well, that's a great place to start, because it started as a community radio show.
Yes. Yes, it started as a half-hour monthly show the third Thursday of every month on KABU Community Radio here in Portland. And I think I did two shows that were live, and then I had a guest who did not show up for my third show, and it was a total disaster. I had never considered that possibility before. What actually happened was he forgot about the interview and overslept, and I called him. And he was like, oh, sorry, I'll be there in like 10 minutes. And like by that time, the show was almost over. And we had this very tense interview where like you could tell that I was like very upset with him. And so I was like, you know what? I think I'm going to pre-record the show from now on. Like that'll be less stressful.
And you had production chops to do that sort of thing. You could produce news packages.
I was learning. I was learning at the time.
Well, we should date this moment then.
Yes. So this was 2006. January of 2006 is when the first episode aired.
And were you archiving it on the internet?
Yes. From the beginning, I was putting it out on Radio for All, if you remember that.
Still exists.
That was a great way to distribute it. And basically, you know, I was putting a lot of work into it once I was pre-recording it, you know, because, of course, then you're editing it, you're putting in some music bumpers, you're, like, you know, adding different elements to the show. And I was experimenting with that and having a lot of fun with it. But I was like, people are not marking their calendars for the third Thursday of the month to listen to my 30-minute, you know, radio creation. So why don't I put it on the internet? And I remember there was a station. So that was something that stations could access, but it also made it a podcast, which no one knew what a podcast was in 2006. I remember on the website, it was like, it's sort of like a magazine. You subscribe and it comes to you. But somebody in Nova Scotia downloaded it and broadcasted it on a station there. And I was so excited. I was like, people in Nova Scotia are listening to this show.
They were airing my show at that time that I was doing. So I think it is the exact same station in Halifax.
Yes, in Halifax.
airing, and that is fantastic.
Radio for All was available to community stations to use for no money and producers to use for no money. So it was this... Yes.
Is a really indie media kind of thing. It was really the first place online for sharing radio segments like that. And it's still around.
Yep.
And then your show evolved.
It evolved, yes. So then, okay, so I did it as a half-hour monthly program on KBOO for, I want to say, 2.5 years. And then I got this job at Think Out Loud. So at the time, I was doing freelance work for FSRN, Free Speech Radio News, and for other... you know, outlets. I had done some work for OPB. And then I got a job working at the now defunct Just Out newspaper. And so I was doing that. And I was doing some radio freelance work. And then I got this job at Think Out Loud. And at first, it was a temporary position. The show had just started. This was January 2008. And then it was a full-time regular position after a few months. And it was hard to do that job and produce the show monthly. So I was trying to figure that out. And then, you know, basically OPB had expressed interest in putting it on as a public radio show. And that meant that it had to be an hour long and it had to have like very specific time, you know, constraints in terms of like it had to be an hour, but it also had to have these 1 minute breaks and it had to be exactly 59 minutes added up and all of this stuff. And so it took me a couple years to figure out how to do that. And I took some time away from the show to kind of figure that out. And I also had to raise some money because I realized that I wanted other people to work as hard on the show as I was working on it. And it was only fair to pay them to do that.
And when OPB offered to air it in that hour long format, was that also as a volunteer, the way you were working at KBOO?
Yeah. So they were basically, they couldn't pay me to do two jobs.
Yes.
So they were already paying me for 40 hours
of work.
You're
lucky to have one job at a radio
station.
Well,
you know, and they were paying me for 40 hours a week of work. And so it was kind of like... Yeah, I kind of didn't realize what I was getting myself into, but it was kind of like, oh, well, you want to put the show on. Like, that's exciting. Like, a public radio station wants to put the show on. Maybe other public radio stations will want to put the show on. But sadly, it also meant that for a while I couldn't air it on KBOO because OPB wanted to be the only ones that aired it in Oregon. That was later changed, but that was an awkward phone call, and I still feel really bad about it. But yeah, so I jumped at the chance to create a public radio show for free and raise money by myself to pay other people to help me. And, you know, it seemed like a good idea at the time.
Well, I mean, I think that that's interesting because I suspect a lot of people think public radio, they're just oceans of money by comparison, right?
By comparison to community radio.
Yeah, or even, you know... compared maybe even to commercial radio because it seems so produced. It's the production values are so high and their examples are going to be something like the Car Guys, right? Not necessarily, you know, and they don't really think about the shows that don't have, you know, 400 affiliate stations that may only have a few affiliate stations and not quite realize that, that therefore there's not the same amount of money paid in to create these shows or distribute them or that many of these shows are self funded and largely self-distributed, and therefore a lot of stations don't really pay for them either.
Yeah, I mean, and I kind of thought at the beginning, I sort of fell into that, and I sort of thought, well, if I could get enough stations to buy the show, even if they're only paying a small amount, then, you know, that could help support it. But that isn't really how it works, because, you know, once you put I mean, really, the unless you're on a network like NPR or American Public Media or PRI, then you don't really have much distribution power. So in addition to producing the show, doing my full-time job and like raising money to pay the other people to help me produce the show that I was doing on the side, I was also calling stations and saying, "Will you put my show on the air?" And they were like, "Who the hell are you?" You know, and it's not, you don't have a lot of clout as the producer, creator, host of the show, also calling a station and being like, "Will you put my show on?" I mean, I can't blame them for not taking me very seriously. But I was putting it up on PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, which is a great resource for independent producers, but also doesn't pay very much because stations won't pay much. You know, at first I was sort of insulted and I was like, really, 50 cents a minute is your base rate? But stations won't pay much more than that. And some stations do pay more because their listenership is higher, and that's how PRX sort of metrics work. But I mean, you know, I get a check for $200 once a quarter from them or something, you know, on average.
From Public Radio Exchange.
From PRX. The Public Radio Exchange for stations downloading shows and pieces of shows to play.
So it then evolves again, right? It becomes a legit podcast, not a public radio show.
Yeah, well, so it was a public radio show. It's called Destination DIY. That's when we changed the name. And I changed the name for a couple reasons, because it was DIY Portland. It was actually DIY, comma, Portland. And I was very fastidious about the comma, and like people would write the show up and I would be like typing an email, "Thank you so much for writing about the show. There's a comma. Did you know?" But like it meant something to me. Anyway, that was annoying. And also I wanted the show to broaden. You know, I wasn't going to fill an hour doing stories all by myself. So I was like, I can buy work from other producers. You know, I can have work from other cities, other countries, you know, other states. And so I wanted it to have a more national scope. And so DIY Portland didn't really make sense anymore. And the website had always been called Destination DIY because DIY Portland was taken. So Destination DIY. And then I was making these hour-long shows, which were very labor-intensive, as you can imagine, you know, doing this 59 minutes, and then you got to have 2 1-minute breaks. And sometimes you had, you know, for more stations to play it, I would have a 5-minute news hole, like a story that was 5 minutes exactly that I could pull out. And there's a lot of like non-creative work that goes into that stuff that's like not very much fun. But I had a great engineer that was working with me, Clark Salisbury, who really helped to kind of shape the sound of the show for public radio and made, you know, great music bumpers out of our theme song and really made it sound very pro. And that was great. But we could still only produce like 3 shows a year, maybe. Hmm. And that's because, not very much content.
This is a fully produced sort of show with segments and features. So unlike sort of what Eric and I do, which is kind of talk and bring in an interview and let it be kind of long form, which also permits us to do it once a week. Right. You were, what we probably put into several weeks or several months of shows, you were putting into one show for
every,
all intents and purposes.
Every word is scripted.
Well, not exactly. Not every word, but I mean, like, there were lots of, there were about 8 or 9 different elements to every show, whether that was a feature or sometimes we'd have a two-way, you know, just an interview, okay. But that always took some editing for time, right? So that it would fit in with the rest of the stuff. Some of the features I was producing, some were being produced by other people, and we were editing them. And so, and there was scripting in between, right? So like if I did a feature, like my parts were scripted, but then there was also, I was hosting the show, so I was sort of knitting it all together under a theme usually and saying, you know, and now we're going to move on to this thing that fits into the theme. And so, yeah, all of that took a lot of work. And so it just wasn't very much content. So OPB would play it and other stations would play it, you know, for 6 weeks at a time. And then they would like run out of shows. So they would play it in like a special. So it didn't have a place that it fit nicely on people's air because it wasn't coming out on a regular basis. And so that kind of hurt us. And so I took some time away from the show, away from Think Out Loud, actually. I took a 3-month sabbatical from Think Out Loud to just kind of try to figure this out because I was like, I did not sign up to be an entrepreneur. You know, like that's not my area of expertise. I just want to make this content. Like, how can I make the content in a way that's more sustainable, that more people will hear it, that it will be more fun for me, that I can produce it more often, that it can reach more listeners. And so that's where the podcast idea came out. And it was kind of like, okay, podcasts are now a thing, right? People are listening to podcasts. This was pre-Serial, but it was like okay, people have heard of podcasts, you know, and post-Roman Mars, pre-serial. Okay.
So this is what's about the approximate year here?
This was 2013, I think.
Okay, so for like 3 years then you were producing it as a public radio show?
So I started in 2014 doing it as a monthly. So I had to raise money first, so I had to come up with a plan for that. So we did an Indiegogo campaign and raised some money to relaunch it as a monthly podcast. And the idea was, okay, if we can take, you know, several months to produce one of these hour-long shows that has 8 or 9 different elements to it, we should be able to produce one element per month and release it that way. And so it was like, there will be one story a month.
Less of a focus on the clock.
Yeah, and less of a focus on the clock. And one of the things I raised money for was to hire a content editor. So someone who would be kind of a backstop for me, that the clock was no longer there, to be that backstop. So it was like, you know, I wanted to have somebody else kind of give me feedback on the content. Because you could make things as long as you want to, but sometimes, you know, you need somebody to say, it doesn't need to be that long, actually. You should take this part out.
Yeah, that's a really... I'm super jealous.
Laura Haddon is our editor, and she's been great to work with. And really, it was fun. We got a lot of applicants, actually, through AIR and the Association of Independents and Radio and other places that I posted the job. And it was super fun to just kind of have that talent pool to pull from. And Laura's been great. And it was so valuable. I mean, we definitely had disagreements, and like that was healthy. And she won most of the time. Mm-hmm. And I think it was for the better.
What did you learn about crowdfunding radio?
I learned that I never want to do it again. It's like a full-time job. The thing about my work is that it was very easy for me to separate. When I go to work from 8 a.m. to, you know, 4 or 5 p.m., I'm working on Think Out Loud. And when I come home or on the weekends, I'm doing my other stuff. And I can schedule interviews around that. And I, you know, sometimes if I was interviewing someone on the East Coast, I would just schedule it for 7 a.m. So I just do it before work. Or, you know, I had a lot of control over that. But a crowdfunding campaign cannot be left alone for 8 hours a day. Mm. And so that was a really big struggle for me. I did a Kickstarter campaign in 2009 and then, or 2010, I think. And then I did the Indiegogo campaign leading up to the release of it being a monthly podcast. And both were very challenging, very, very challenging. And I think one of the things that was challenging is explaining to people why we need money. Because I think people, like you said, they don't sort of think about how shows come together and what that takes and what that, you know, what you're spending money on. But then people would hear us on OPB, you know, and think, oh, they're getting money from OPB.
Right.
And I mean, it was great to air on OPB. And I totally, you know, I'm grateful to them for putting the show on. But I mean, the most money that we ever got from them was like $100 an episode.
Right. I guess we should tell listeners to this show that Oregon Public Broadcasting has a huge reach. It's one of the biggest NPR affiliates.
Yeah, it reaches
in the country.
A large portion of the state of Oregon.
Yes, yes. So you said Think Out Loud airs every day at noon in Portland, but it actually airs every day at noon all over the state of Oregon and Southwest Washington. And so it's a very wide reach, and it's a very beloved station. You know, I mean, never have I had the experience that I have calling from the OPB newsroom, calling from any other newsroom in this, you know, in this place or any other place. Just calling people up at cold calls, as you do as a journalist, and saying, I'm calling from OPB. And most people are thrilled. Like, they're excited to be talking to OPB because they have such a great respect for the station.
So your show got a certain amount of a cachet from airing on the on such a widely appreciated station. But then it also was a little...
It was a double-edged sword, because then we had to explain to people, like, we don't actually get any money from the station, or we get a very small amount of money from the station. And then, you know, and there's a way to sort of, you have to strike a tone with that, right? Where I don't want to sound like I'm complaining, but I have to explain to you that, like, you may have this perception that the show has more financial resources than it actually does. So
it's on NPR.
It's an independent show, right? Because people confuse NPR and OPB all the time, as they do with other stations, of course. You know, they'll say, oh, I heard you on NPR. No, you didn't. But it was challenging. And I think just the crowdfunding thing itself, I mean, as crowdfunding has gotten more popular, it's gotten harder. I mean, more, it's not as novel and exciting for people to give to a crowdfunding campaign. I mean, we did have, so for the Indiegogo campaign, because I'd been through the Kickstarter campaign and I knew what I was up against. I knew it was going to be really challenging and that I didn't want to have the tension that I had before of kind of, you know, trying to deal with it while I was at work. So I had two fabulous interns, Rachel Milbauer and Bethany Denton, who were my go-to gals for the 8 hours a day that I was at work. You know, I would just give them a roster of things to do.
So what kind of things do you have to do?
It was mostly, one of them was in charge of thanking people publicly on Twitter and Facebook, because the more you do that, the more people are reminded to give, and people appreciate being thanked, of course. So one of them was in charge of thanking people, and the other one was in charge of pushing and asking for more donations.
So just on social media.
Yeah, on social media. And so it was like, you know, today let's push the t-shirts or like, you know, we have a matching gift from so-and-so. So it was like very public radio in that way. Yeah. Yeah, it was just like Pledge Drive.
And you'll notice that stations only do Pledge Drive for a few days or a week at a time because it takes over, doesn't it?
It really does. It really does. And there's something exciting about it, but it's also sort of an emotional roller coaster because you can, I mean, if you think about like when you give to a crowdfunding campaign or a public radio station that's doing a pledge drive, there's no rhyme or reason to when or why, like when you time that gift, you know, you're just like, oh, it's convenient for me. I'm here, you know, at my house with my phone and I'm just going to do it right now. Or, you know, and so it's hard when you're on the other side not to take it personally when people are not giving, you know, it's just a lull in that day or whatever. And you're like, what am I doing wrong? Like, why do people hate my show? And it's just, it's hard to not get caught up in that sort of.
But you were successful.
Well, so the Indiegogo campaign was not an all or nothing the way Kickstarter was.
Is that why you chose it? Chose that
it's
platform?
Not actually. And I wouldn't recommend it because I think that does not.
They call it flexible funding.
The flexible funding. Thank you. And it decreases the urgency for people. Mm-hmm. So the only reason I chose it was because when we did Kickstarter, so this is going to get like a little bit in the weeds on crowdfunding. So feel free to edit it out.
Listeners might care though.
But it's interesting. So what people don't tell you about crowdfunding is that that money is taxable.
Right.
So that's something a lot of people don't think about building into their campaign strategy.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is about timing. So we did our Kickstarter in June. It ended in June of 2010. And we raised about $10,000. And it was all budgeted for hour-long shows that were coming down the line, like 5 shows that we had planned. But it was not all spent in the same year that it was raised. And so at the end of the year, the LLC, Destination DIY LLC, got this huge tax bill as if we had made a giant profit. And I was like, I was totally shocked by this. And I was like, oh my God, I need to do a Kickstarter to pay taxes on my Kickstarter. And so that was a bummer. And I did not want to have that happen again. So I went through a fiscal sponsor, which is Fractured Atlas, which is a great organization that helps a lot of artists and a lot of different media do the kinds of things that you can't do if you're not a nonprofit yourself.
Right. This is really important advice for people who might be thinking about crowdfunding a radio or podcast.
Yes. So, Fractured Atlas is great.
So find a nonprofit that supports the arts somewhere around your community.
Yes, that can be a fiscal sponsor for you. And Fractured Atlas is everywhere. They're not just in Portland, so they're online. And I actually found them through AIR, through the Association of Independence and Radio. And Fractured Atlas partners with Indiegogo so that you don't pay fees twice. Basically, if you raise money through Indiegogo in partnership with Fractured Atlas, they put a little logo on your Indiegogo page that says this is a Fractured Atlas project. And you pay one fee, which is, you know, like a 7% fee on your donations that you get, and you pay, instead of paying Fractured Atlas and Indiegogo, you're just paying one fee. And they don't have that with Kickstarter. So if I went through Kickstarter, I'd be paying the 10% that Kickstarter and Amazon take, and then the 7% that Fractured Atlas would take. So I just really didn't think that was a good option, and we just have to raise more.
And it was successful, though.
It was. It was like, okay, so our goal was high. Our goal was too high. It was like 20,000, and we raised about 15,000, right, which at the time, I did not think of as a success until people started to describe it that way. And I would, you know, people were like, congratulations.
You were probably comparing yourself to Roman Mars's.
A little bit. Yeah, I was. And it's hard not to.
And I think everybody who's listening probably is aware of this already. But Roman Mars used Kickstarter more than once to raise over $100,000 for his program.
I think he raised over $300,000 in his first Kickstarter. And well
blew
deserved.
Everyone's minds.
Well right. deserved. But yeah, it's hard not to compare yourself to that. And I just you know, it was hard to accept for a while, but then I was like, okay, it's like I got a C in a really hard class. You know, like I need to accept that this is actually some semblance of success here.
So now you have a podcast and you're making it. Did
right.
it did so, that did it was that nice? I mean,
yeah.
What was that like?
It was great. It was great. So I was making the podcast, and then I was like, it was interesting because I no longer had the accidental listeners that you get through the radio. People who will hear the show because they just switched it on in the car or while they're doing dishes or whatever. People had to seek it out. And there were definitely people that were seeking it out, but I was kind of bummed out because I would like go out and I would see people who, if it had been on the radio, would always come up to me and be like, oh, I heard the show and here's like 9 things I want to tell you about it. And they would just not have anything to say. And sometimes they would say, are you still doing that show? And I'd be like, once a month, please listen to it. And so I really started to feel like, you know, are we reaching people? Was this the right decision? And I was seeing, I was also seeing fundraising looming on the horizon, you know, because once you do it, you know, then you have a finite amount of money. And then when you spend it all, you have to raise more. And so I was thinking about that. And I was like, and that's when I actually began to think about not doing the show anymore, because I loved making the content. And it was so fun to make it once a month, because it was fun to share things that I had just made. Because the downside of the hour long show production, there are many downsides, but one of the downsides is that you know you go and you interview people and you cut the interviews and you script it and you put it all together and then you're kind of like put it on the shelf until everything else is done.
Yeah.
And so not only are you not that excited about it because you're not that close to it anymore when it comes out, but the people who were part of it are not that close to it. Oh yeah, that thing that I did months ago, you know. So it was exciting to like go out, interview people, and then like release this thing right when I'm like the most excited to share it, right when the people who, you know, I've interviewed have it fresh in their minds and have it kind of go out that way. That was really fun. And I did some fun collaborations with other podcasts that were really cool. And I learned a lot about sort of like how different shows, you know, approach production. I did a podcast crossover with Life of the Law and with Roman Mars, 99% Invisible. It was really fun. So
you did that as a podcast about 2 years, is that right?
Yeah. So we started in, I think it was January 2014. So did it for about 2 years.
And in that time, I mean, you also hooked up with a couple podcast networks. Is that correct?
Well, so yeah. So then as I was sort of thinking about like, what am I going to do and how am I going to raise money? This podcast network called Mule approached me, and I joined Mule, and it was a very brief relationship because shortly after we joined the network, they decided they didn't want to be a podcast network anymore. So that was kind of awkward.
And what was the advantage of joining up with Mule at that time, a network in general, I guess?
Basically, it was sort of taking some of the logistical fundraising things off my plate. Hmm. I mean, not entirely, but like I had never been successful at finding sponsors outside of local nonprofits that wanted to sponsor the show when it was a radio show. And we're not as happy to sponsor it as a podcast, understandably, because they weren't reaching that wide OPB audience that they wanted to reach. And so, I mean, calling program directors was one thing, but like, I don't even know what the magic words are when you call and ask people to sponsor your show. And I mean, I didn't have a lot to offer them. Like, I'd be like, you could reach 5,000 people, you know, eventually. Once they all download the show.
So Mule offered up to try and find advertisers.
Yeah. So that was the main draw, was that they offered to help find us advertisers and also kind of raise the profile a bit.
Right. Because they had other podcasts that were relatively successful. So, yeah. So it's sort of, you get the brand name recognition.
Yeah. So we did that. And it just didn't last very long, but we did get a bit of, we got some Squarespace spots from them, which was cool because, you know, everybody needs a Squarespace spot.
Exactly. Are you listening, Squarespace?
I think Squarespace is like, soon they're going to figure out that they've saturated the market and they're just going to pull out and all these podcasts are going to fail. I know, I hope that doesn't happen. But I remember Jamie Cuddy, who worked on the show with me for a long time, said, oh, we're like a real grown-up show. We have a Squarespace.
Spot. Right, right.
So that was cool. And then so then Mule folded, and we had never depended on the Mule money because they kind of came in at a weird time. It was like after the Indiegogo campaign, but before I had really started to stress about fundraising. And so I was kind of like, OK, well, I'll just think of this as like, what could we do if we had another couple hundred dollars, you know, and not build it into the budget. And so it wasn't a huge loss for us. But I think that I probably shouldn't say this. I think the guy who ran the company that Mule was under, which I don't think is called Mule, or maybe it's like Mule something
else. It's like a design company.
It's a design company. Yeah. And he gave a quote to Current where he described what they were doing as extra beer money for everybody, which I found really insulting. But I never worked with him. I worked with Lena Matsitsis, who then went on to work with Gimlet, and I think now is working with Here Be Monsters.
Oh,
anyway,
okay.
she was great to work with. And so, you know, she was my only contact at Mule and she was terrific. So, you know, Mule folded. There was that Current article that came out and they quoted me in the article. And after the Current article came out, Jesse Thorne, who I had met, you know, many times at radio conferences, the public mm-hmm. radio world and the community radio world are very small. And so Jesse Thorne, who has this successful NPR show called Bullseye, and a podcast network called Maximum Fun that mostly caters to comedy podcast listeners, sent me like a one sentence email that was like, if you ever want to talk about joining Maximum Fun, let me know. And I was like, of course I want to talk to you about joining Maximum Fun. That sounds great. And so that was kind of my moment where I was like, okay, I've been thinking about shutting this down because I've been sort of weighing like, the fun stuff and the not fun stuff and like what takes up more of my time and like where am I putting my energy. And I'm kind of like, that was sort of like when that decision was starting to percolate for me. And I thought, well, why don't I try this? You know, like I didn't want to shut down the show. And I thought, okay, well, I'll see what joining Maximum Fun can do for us, you mm-hmm. know, like, will that take some of this? Because the attractive thing about Maximum Fun, not only was it, you know, raising the profile by reaching a new audience through, you know, their shows cross promote a lot. And the idea that they could help find sponsors for us, but they do their own pledge drive. They do
right.
across
yeah.
the network. All the shows do a pledge drive. And that was very attractive because it was like, okay, that solves my crowdfunding problem.
Yeah, they do a lot more listener funding compared to some podcast networks.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a very good model that's been working for them for a long time. I mean, they kind of are the original podcast network.
Yeah.
I mean, whenever I read articles that are like podcast networks are like the new thing, Radiotopia, which is great, but like they're not, they didn't invent it. You know, Jesse kind of invented it.
Jesse might have invented podcasting
because
of his
possible.
Sound of Young America. I was telling Paul a couple weeks ago that the first time anybody in my life ever said, this is a podcast, you should listen to this, it was Sound of Young America.
Yeah.
So how did it go with Maximum Fun? So you joined up with the network and did you get some more funding? Did you get that extra exposure? How did that work out for Destination DIY?
It worked out really well. So we joined about a year ago. So it was our September 2014 episode that was the first episode that was officially on Maximum Fun. And it was very cool. I mean, the cross promotion was great. I mean, our audience numbers went up significantly. They did this cool thing the month after we joined that was called Max Fun Week, where it was not fundraising, but they did a ton of cross promotion on different shows. And like and I think can't remember how it worked exactly, but there was a lot of, you know, there was just a lot of excitement that was generated. And it was kind of along the lines of things that you would do during a pledge drive, but they didn't ask people for money, which I think was mm-hmm. really smart because then
so
they were going to
really
ask people for money months down the road.
Generate engagement, get people
yeah.
involved and thinking about the bigger plan of Maximum Fun and not just the one show they listen to.
Absolutely. And that was, and you know, we made promos that other shows aired. I mean, I heard mm-hmm. them on other shows that had much bigger audiences, which was really exciting. I mean, Judge John Hodgman's show.
Right.
And, you know, the My Brother, My Brother and Me. and they have their own kind of like franchise within Maximum Fun, and you know, and they had this new pop culture discussion show called Pop Rocket that was really popular, you know, right off the bat, and you know, a lot of those shows were very generous in airing our promos, and that was great. And then we did Pledge Drive with them, and we had. And then they offered to do this thing. They had a new thing that they were starting that was the Maximum Fun listener panel, where they were going to get feedback from listeners, which is something that I'd never been able to do because I just never had the resources to do it.
Yeah, some radio stations don't even pull that one off.
And it was so appealing to me. I was like, oh, I totally want to be part of that. So I let Jesse know right away, you know, this sounds really awesome. I would love to be a part of it. And he was like, great. You're going to be the first show that we... you know, experiment with on this new thing. So it was like 200 people who had signed up. And Maximum Fun has some amazing listeners. They're so engaged. You know, they're so into Maximum Fun, and they're so into, like, the things that Maximum Fun puts out that they're just like...
Right. He puts on a cruise.
Yeah,
People get on a boat together because they like
podcasts.
My
friend goes on that cruise.
And Max Fun Con, which is the other thing that they do every year. And so, yeah, I mean, it's a niche thing, but the people who are into it are super into it. They are like a special brand of nerd, and they're so wonderful. And so they were, they signed up immediately. A lot of people, I think 200 people or so, signed up immediately for this listener panel. And it allowed us to do a survey of, you know, self-selected people, but mostly people who hadn't heard the show before, as it turned out. And so we wrote the questions, we picked the episodes that they listened to, and then, and, you know, a lot of the questions were things like, you know, rating, like, you know, how much did you like the show? You know, poor, fair, good, great. You know, what did you think of the host? Poor, fair, good, great. That one went okay. I was a little nervous. But, and then there were some open-ended questions, like, how would you describe this show to someone who's never heard it? And what would you change about the show? And like fully 2/3 of the people said to the very open-ended question, what would you change about the show? Change the name. Because it's confusing. Because I thought it was going to be about crafts and home improvement. And that's not something that I thought I would be into, but I'm into this show. So basically their message was, we are your audience. Your name is a barrier.
This is not the DIY network.
Yeah.
Right?
And I mean, I don't know why I was surprised by that, because for the entire time that I've been doing the show, I've been explaining to people what DIY does not mean in the context of the show. And because to me, it means like, you know, the punk movement. It means doing things without permission. It means doing things in an innovative way. It means doing things on the cheap and doing things in, you know, a way that maybe you don't, you know, has never been done before. And so I'd always been explaining to people that it's not Bob Vila and Martha Stewart, you know? And so I realized, like, okay, I've been fighting that battle for a really long time, and it's kind of unnecessary. Like, I should just rename the show. And we had this great opportunity because in February, so it was February of this year, we were doing another collaboration with Roman Mars, a 99% Invisible. So we were going to reach his giant audience. And I was like, okay, we need to rebrand the show before that.
Mm-hmm. Smart.
You know, so that we can, you know, launch our new name with that episode. And that's what we did. And that's when it became Rendered.
And that was a really special episode of Rendered.
Yeah, why don't you tell us about that episode?
Sure. So this was something that Roman and I cooked up at the Third Coast Audio Festival, which is a fantastic, it's like everybody's favorite radio conference. It's for independent radio producers, and it's a super fun time. There's lots of fun workshops. There's lots of fun social time. And so I was telling Roman about the carpet at PDX Airport. And I was like, people are nuts for this carpet. It is totally weird, totally inexplicable. And, you know, about a year ago, they said they were going to take the carpet out. And I don't know when it's happening, but, you know, people have been going nuts about it, you know, for quite a while.
It became a thing that you would take your picture of your feet standing at it and then put that on the Facebook and the Instagram and the Twitter.
And it would tell people, I'm leaving on a plane, or I'm coming home on a plane.
I'm here in Portland again.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a very distinctive carpet. It's like this teal color. If you don't live in Portland, if you haven't seen it, it's this teal color with this sort of like geometric pattern on it that's like purple and red and black.
Very 80s. Right?
Yeah, it's very 80s. Very, very 80s. It's kind of a so ugly, it's beautiful thing, I think. So anyway, Roman was like, we have to do a show about this. It practically writes itself. And when I sat down to write it, I can tell you he was right. It it basically did, you know. And so I found out what the timing was. You know, they were taking that, they were going to start to take the carpet up at the end of January. And I was like, all right, I want to be there, you know, when they rip the carpet up. You know, like, I want to just tell me when it's happening. They're like, a lot of this work is going to happen in the middle of the night because, you know, that's when people are not using the airport. And I was like, tell me when to be there and I will be there. And then they ended up doing like an 11 a.m. Friday media event because I was not the only person who wanted to be there when the carpet was ripped up for the first time. So that was convenient. and you know, I got that great sound of like the glue ripping off the right. floor, just this rip. And it was fun. So, you know, and it was fun to do it with Roman because it was like you had the Portland perspective, but then you had Roman's perspective as like an outsider being like, this is a little crazy, like, right? This is crazy. Mm-hmm. And so it's fun to have that kind of back and forth because that's how he hosts his show, is when he has someone else produce. He doesn't just turn over the show to them. He kind of hosts from within the piece. And there's a lot of like back and forth between him and the producer.
Yeah, it's a really innovative writing style or
yeah.
Radio production style.
And it was fun to write for his voice. It was fun to write it that way. And then, of course, you know, he added some things and changed some things. But it was fun to kind of think about that production style when I was writing it.
So that that podcast was a hit. Did that boost your listeners?
It did for sure. Yeah, I mean, it was a hit because it was 99% invisible and also because of the carpet,
and it might have been a Portland moment anyway for
yeah.
some reason.
Well, and PDX carpet is a hashtag on Twitter, and anything we tweeted about the show had that hashtag. And so people who had never heard of 99% invisible, never heard of Rendered or Destination DIY were listening to it because they saw their interest in the carpet. And so it was kind of funny because it came out in February, and so it was sort of after a lot of media coverage of the carpet had happened, and so I was a little worried that people were going to be like, oh, I'm so done with the dumb carpet. And I was a little done with the carpet myself by that point. But it was great. It was fun, and it struck the right tone, and it was just kind of one of those magical moments.
Right, and I mean, for the 1% of our listeners who don't know 99% Invisible, it's a design podcast, so it's not just this cute idea for the show, but it's very much it's great that your podcast about I guess it's a little less about Rendered. I wanted to
well,
say it all
ours is together. About creativity. I mean, Rendered was about creativity, and that was it was convenient that we changed the name because there's not a whole lot that's like DIY about it, except that I mean, to me, the most interesting thing about it is that it was this organic thing that happened. Like, the airport didn't suddenly start saying, oh, everyone, pay attention to our carpet and, like, start marketing around the carpet, because that never would have worked. I mean, people would not have bought into that. It just became this thing where, like, it, you know, people started taking pictures of their feet, and then more people started taking pictures of their feet, and then people fell in love with the carpet and actually blindsided the airport with it when they decided to replace the carpet. They realized that it had become a meme. And so I liked that aspect of it. It was definitely like a populist thing. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of how I justified it on the show. But I didn't have to like have this long explanation of it in my intro or anything because I didn't have to make it about DIY. It was about creativity.
Right. And so that was in February that you released that episode. Now we're here in September of 2015, and you've decided to hang up your headphones for the moment.
Yes, I have. So this was the decision that I sort of started considering about a year, last summer, let's say, summer 2014. You know, do I want to go through this again? How am I going to raise the money? And, you know, the Maximum Fun experiment worked to a certain degree. You know, we did do a pledge drive following that PDX carpet episode. The next month was their pledge drive, and we followed it up with an episode about choose your own adventure books, which was really fun and really a hit with the Maximum Fun audience, as you can imagine. And we didn't raise as much in the drive as I had hoped to raise. And so I could sort of see this time when we would run out of money. You know, I could do the math and be like, okay, how little can we spend? Because truthfully, so I'm not paid. I don't pay myself because I have a job, you know, and I pay the editor, I pay the engineer, and then I pay for all the little things like web hosting and, you know, or actually we didn't have to pay for web hosting because Maximum Fun was hosting the website, but we're paying for the domain names and paying for our PO box and paying for, you know, the occasional transcription and paying our membership fees at PRX and all these other little things and tape syncs and all of these things that happen. And I was like, okay, if we spend the bare minimum, like I can see down the road, like that's when we'll run out of money, you know, and what am I going to do about that? And so I sort of came back to this, you know, decision that I've been considering about shutting down the show. And I didn't like the idea, but then, you know, it kind of was like, and then I got pregnant. And I sort of thought, when I got pregnant, I was like, I will just figure it out. I don't know what I'm going to do with the show, but I'll figure it out. The solution will present itself, you know? And I did think that I had a viable solution because, so basically, my baby is due in January of 2016.
Your first baby.
My first baby.
Congratulations.
Yes, I'm becoming a mom. And my baby's due in January, so I'm 5 months pregnant, just shy of 5 months pregnant. And so I thought, okay, I can take January off. I can take February off. March is when Maximum Fun does their pledge drive, so I could pre-produce an episode for that and take that off and come back in April, which is, of course, when I'm coming back to work at my job. And, I mean, it didn't seem like the best plan, but it seemed like a plan that might work. And it sort of solved the money problem because it was like, okay, we won't have to spend money on the January episode or the February episode, so mm-hmm. we can make our money last longer. And I was like, this has got to be the first time that a baby ever solved a money problem, right? And so I thought it was a great idea. And then, you know, I ran it by the folks, the good folks at Maximum Fun, and they were kind of like, yeah, I don't know if it's the best idea for you to come back at the pledge drive episode. You know, you might want to pre-produce an episode for February. And at this point, I'm in my first trimester, and I was so tired all the time. It's a thing that happens. It's a biological thing that happens to a lot of women in the first trimester. And so basically, I was dragging myself out of bed, dragging myself to work, dragging myself through the day, dragging myself home, and not wanting to do anything else. So even working on the stuff that I had set up for myself to work on for the show, to produce whatever, you know, things I was, you know, committed to producing for that month seemed almost impossible. And to think about pre-producing two episodes by the end of the year before having this baby seemed completely impossible. And so that was kind of the thing that pushed me over the edge. Like I had been sort of thinking about this and I'd been wrestling with it and I'd been, you know, weighing the pros and cons. And one night I went to bed and I woke up at 4 a.m. and I just thought, this is what I have to do. Like I have to shut down the show. Mm-hmm. It's the best thing for me. It's, you know, it's had a great run. It never really found a huge audience, you know, and so it's just maybe time for me to move on.
And do you mind putting a number on that? So I think that helps to for people to kind of under, I mean, well, we do a little bit of this pulling back the curtain here, I think.
Yeah.
So what kind of audience were you reaching?
It's such a hard question to answer, as you know, doing a podcast, yeah. right? Because iTunes doesn't exactly give you like a printout every month right. of like how
so
many
you,
people
you have your download number basically to go
listen
on,
to the
right?
show. But I go through SoundCloud, and SoundCloud mm-hmm. has great metrics. And so we were reaching under 10,000. So it was between 7,000 and 9,000 listens per episode is kind of where it capped out. And it's just not a lot, you know?
It's so many.
It's so many
it's
on the one
so
hand.
So many, but then it's not. You know, it's like, yes, 8,000 people is a ton of people. Oh my gosh. But if you think about how many people Think Out Loud reaches on a given day, just a day, and I don't know what the number is off the top of my head, but it's a lot bigger than 10,000, mm-hmm. you know? And so it's like, it's just...
And yet a show on a community radio station at any given day may not reach as many as 10,000 people.
True.
But it's just these numbers people don't always think about. And I think, you know, people think, well, what about a serial or what about a This American Life?
Right.
Those are hundreds of thousands into a million downloads an episode. But your average, even in the top 100 iTunes podcasts, don't reach those right. sort of stratospheric numbers.
Paul, because of your day job.
Yes.
I'm going to out you again at mid-roll.
Yeah, that's right.
You can actually put a number roughly to what a podcast needs for the for the host of that podcast to make a living wage.
Well, I don't even, I can't even say that. A living wage. Yeah. I can say that if you're talking about advertisers, generally speaking, it's hard to sell under about 30,000 downloads an episode. Now, it doesn't say it doesn't happen because there are niches or, you know, shows that just for whatever reason appeal to a particular audience that is more attractive just to certain advertisers. So, you know, in the same way that maybe a small magazine is appealing. But that's right. That's significantly more than you had at that time.
Well, it's significantly more than I ever had.
Right.
I mean, at that time being now, I mean, really, I think, and I knew that, you know, I mean, I would talk to Maximum Fun contracts with these great folks that, that sell ads for them. And, you know, they would say, your content is great. We are so excited to sell ads around it, but it's hard to sell. I mean, you know, they were honest with me, it's hard to sell these listener numbers, you know, and we didn't get very many sponsorship spots from them. And the ones that we got were pretty small potatoes. And so, you know, it was an economic problem. Like, I mean, I don't, I, it's really important to me that people not just say, okay, well, Julie decided to be a mom, so she's not gonna do this podcast anymore, because it's not that simple. It's really a narrative that is much more universal across podcasting that is an economics problem. And I think that it faces, that, that women face it differently than men, because women often have more responsibilities outside of work, I think it's safe to say. And that those responsibilities can basically make it so that you don't have extra time to make your podcast if you're not being paid for it. But it's, I, it's a problem that a lot of people face, and a lot of people who are perceived as successful podcasters face, because a lot of people who are perceived as successful podcasters have other jobs and other sources of income.
You made this, I just want to reiterate, you made this really important decision on your podcast that you were going to have a staff. You're going to pay people for their work to make your podcast better. So you were, and then you were a volunteer.
Well, yeah, that's true. But
that's strange.
Basically because
or unique.
I think, but I think that's a story that a lot of entrepreneurs in any field would tell you, that they're the last ones to be paid.
Right.
Because if you hire other people, you're making a commitment to those people that you're going to pay them. I mean, let me be clear that this was all contract labor. I mean, I wasn't employing anyone. I wasn't responsible for anyone's livelihood, you know, completely, but I was paying people an hourly wage to work on the show.
Which is still unique in the world of the podcasts.
Not unique, I would say,
but
certainly not something that everybody makes the choice to do. But I don't even want to think about what, how low our listener numbers would have been and how unsuccessful the show would have been if I was doing it all by myself.
And what is there a situation in which you would want to continue doing the show now, taking for granted that you're going to have a child? So in this circumstance, do you think that there's a way in which you would feel like, no, I will find a way to keep this going? And it can be, and think big. I mean, so, you know, not just like incremental from where you are, but do you think there would have been a situation which you would feel like, no, I'm going to keep doing this?
I guess it's possible. But it would have to be pretty dramatic. And I think that one of the reasons that I was considering this decision before the baby came into the picture was that I felt like I was cutting myself off from other opportunities, because I was, when I wasn't working or having a life, I was doing my show. And so when people would approach me about other projects I might want to work on that were not necessarily paid or that were one-off things, you know, that seemed cool, I would often have to say no. And I think that there were things that I wasn't even asked to do because, and I didn't even seek out because I was working on the show and I was so focused on it. And so I think that one of the things that I'm looking forward to in not doing the show anymore and not having to do, not having the monthly production deadline, having to run my own business, having to think about all of that other stuff, is that I can seek out other opportunities, you know, and I can still produce work for other shows. You know, I can work with Roman, I can work with other podcasts that I've made connections with, you know, and pitch to other shows and things like that, which I just never really had the opportunity to do unless it was overlapping with my work on my own show. And so I think that honestly, I feel really good about this decision. And I feel like it was really gratifying that there was such a great response from people on Twitter and Facebook and just writing me private emails and saying, I really enjoyed your show and I'm sad that you're hanging it up, but I totally understand.
That's because, that, you know, it was 9,000 real people, real listeners, right? And yeah. This is something we talked about earlier in this show and on our last episode, is that while it may not have been the top advertiser monetized level of listeners, that's 9,000 people. That fills a fairly large arena.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that means something to me, you know, and that's why I could never really be successful at the business side of it, because I was always like, it's a lot of people, you know, like, and it was hard for me to hear from sort of like the cold business, you know, bean counting side of things, like, no, it's not a lot of people. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm looking forward to not having to think about that stuff and to just making the work.
So if it had been possible that you had sort of enough listeners, whatever that was, that sort of there was a steady stream of income that maybe that you could share in addition to having enough to hire the people you need to hire, whatever that would be, let you know. Do you think you'd still want to continue doing it? Or do you think really maybe it's something which it's come to an end? Like, you know, because sometimes, I mean, books end. Yeah. Movies end. Often, you know, not every project has to go on forever.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that it's really the latter, because I think for it to be that successful, that it would really be self-sustaining and that I could hire someone to do the things that I'm not good at doing, that I don't want to do in terms of like the accounting and, you know, the business side of things, that I could like offload that. It would have to have reached a wider audience. You know, it would have to have hit a stride that it had many opportunities to hit. I mean, you point out the PDX carpet episode, you know, reached a lot of new people. And for whatever reason, they didn't stick around, or they, you know, listened to that episode and that was it. I don't know. I mean,
no murder.
Yeah.
Right. No Ira Glass promoting it.
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, I don't really know what to. I mean, I feel like I was doing the best work that I could do under the circumstances. But, you know, for whatever reason, it was not reaching an audience that would sustain it. And so I don't know that that's anybody's fault. I think it's just sort of the economics of podcasting once again.
Or the economics of DIY.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and the economics of an oversaturated market. I mean, there are so many podcasts on Midroll alone, right? I mean, and Maximum Fun has like, you know, over 20 podcasts on their network. So not every, you know, there's no one who's listening to all those podcasts. And so you have to find your niche. You have to find that passionate group of people, which, you know, 99% Invisible has found. And, you know, it's sort of inexplicable because nobody can say exactly. I mean, it's a great podcast, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of great podcasts. And right. So it's like, why this one and not that one? And I made a list of things that I am not going to miss. And on that list is like thinking about this, because I don't know the answer. You know, I don't know why when people make lists of their favorite podcast, my podcast isn't on it very often.
And would you do it again, though?
Yeah, I would. I would do it differently. I would do it with a different idea. I would do it with a business plan. I would do it, you know.
I guess you kind of stumbled into it. I mean, it started out as just a community radio show.
Totally.
And no one gets, I mean, generally speaking, people don't start a community radio station on a mostly volunteer program station with the idea of this is my future career most of the time. Mostly it's, I'm very interested in this topic. I really like to share it. I love radio. The people at the station are cool. This is a lot of fun.
And those were exactly my motivations, you know. And this show, I mean, the truth is that this show developed alongside my own career, you know. And mm-hmm. as my career became more professional and I entered the world of public radio, I brought the show with me. And when podcasting became more of a viable option and I became more interested in podcasting as a medium, I brought the show with me there. And so it was a lot of stumbling around, because it was like, okay, well, now I need this. I mean, basically, when I decided, okay, I need to pay people, it was because a person that I've been working with for a long time, who'd been working with me as a volunteer, was like, you know what? I can't do this anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm in a band. I have a job. I do this show. I have a girlfriend. And like, I can't do all of these things. And I'm sorry, but this is going to have to be the thing that goes. And I couldn't argue with him. And eventually he came back, which was great. And I'm able to, you know, was able to pay him to work on the show later on, which was awesome. But I totally, you know, it sucked in the moment, but I thanked him later because I was like, that was the wake up call that I needed to pay people to do this.
Right.
You know?
And if you were going to give somebody advice right now, who's thinking about doing a podcast, and I guess, it, you know, I always, you know, so it's a standard question in a way, well, someone wants to do a podcast. And yet the problem is, of course, well, why? Why does someone want to do a podcast? You know, and so if you think about that, let me re-ask the question. And the question is, why do you think someone should do a podcast?
Oh, I'm like the worst person to ask this about. Okay, so I'll start by saying that Laura, my editor, when she read the script for the last episode of Rendered, was like, I feel like this is going to be really discouraging to people who might want to start a podcast. And I was like, I'm okay with that. Mm-hmm. Because people need to know what they're getting themselves into. And I've consulted with people who want to start a podcast, you know, and I think just think about how it's going to fit into your life. Like, how much time is it going to take? And what do you want to do with it? What are your ambitions for it? And I think it's the same thing as any creative project, you know, like starting a band or, you know, anything that you're like, I just feel compelled to pursue this. You know, are you going to play shows in your hometown on weekends and that's going to be really satisfying for you and you're not going to, you know, you're going to get paid by the door money and that's going to be your beer money for the night, right? Are you happy with that? Because that is totally cool. If you are starting a band because you think you're going to get signed by a major label and you're going to be playing stadiums full of tens of thousands of people next year, you should think twice.
And you should make a plan.
Yeah.
To do that.
You should have a backup plan, too.
And I think that's a great comparison because I think it's – because it, being a musician and starting a band is often something which, yes, some people – and sometimes it's inexplicable why one band ends up being a you know, multi-platinum seller while another band doesn't. And there are some bands that go into it more professionally with professional ambitions and some people who go into it because they're like, yeah, exactly. Saturday night, I'd rather be spending it with my bandmates playing up on stage and – right, getting some beer money as opposed to sitting home and watching movies or something else. So that's it's good for me. And maybe this was an implicit in much of what you said, but I'm going to ask it explicitly. What do you think your ambitions were? Did they change over time for the show?
Oh, they definitely changed over time. I mean, what you described as kind of why people start a community radio show was totally like, yeah, this will be fun. This will be a way for me to learn and work on my skills and have a deadline. You know, I like to have that structure. And it was kind of like, I had a lot of time in my life, you know, I was 25 or something. And I was like, you know, I have time to do this, to work on a new project. And this seems like a fun project. And at the time, I was also sort of in my career. I had been working at KBOO as an interim news director. And I was totally not qualified for that job. And I was really devastated that I didn't get the actual job. You know, I was like the interim person and then I didn't get the full-time job. And I was super, super bummed out about it. But I sort of thought, well, how am I going to continue to keep radio in my life? You know, I'm going to have to look for another job, but I want to have something that keeps this alive for me. And the idea of DIY was like so appealing because it was like, oh, so many things that I'm interested in fall under this umbrella of, you know, just people doing stuff that's interesting. You know, you can fit almost anything under there. And yet there are stories that, you know, didn't fit that I'm now, you know, thinking about doing. So anyway, I just think that then when it was like, oh, but it could be on public radio and it could reach this wider audience, I started to have those bigger ambitions, really naively thinking, you know, like, this is going to be my major label break, you know, like, this is going to be my hit single and like, I'm going to make it. And this is going to be my whole job is making this show. If I just work hard enough and I just work, you know, smart enough on it. And at a certain point, and I think it was around the time that I decided that it should be a monthly podcast, I realized that wasn't going to happen. And I mean, fortunately, I love my job. You know, I didn't want to leave my job. I just really wanted to do this show. And I, when I decided to make it a monthly podcast, it was kind of me saying, like, I'm going to play on the weekends with my friends for beer money.
Uh-huh.
You know, this is my version of that. And it seems manageable. and sustainable.
And it ran its course.
And it was for a while, yeah. and then it was just kind of like, all right, I think we're done with this, you know? I mean, I can't tell you how sure I felt about it from the moment mm-hmm. that I woke up at 4 a.m. thinking, this is what I need to do. And because I think I was really making, I was struggling with the decision because I was making it from a really emotional place and sort of going like, fine, I'll just do this because people aren't listening to it and I'm mad about it, you know? And then I would be like, no, I'm not going to do that because that's a dumb reason to stop doing it. And that's not really true. And then I just was like looking at it really practically. It was like, you know what? This has been awesome. And it's a great body of work and I'm really proud of mm-hmm. it. And I'm ready to do something else.
First, I'm going to start a podcast next week called Beer Money.
Awesome. Yeah. Please do that.
For Beer Money. Two. So now it lives in archives.
Yes.
Do you have a plan for how to sustain it so that even though it won't be fresh, it will still be around?
Well, I mean, so I'm still tying up some loose ends. We've released the last episode. But I'm in the process of moving our archives over to a website that is not Maximum Fun's website, where they can live in perpetuity, and they will continue to live on SoundCloud and the website renderedradio.org, which will just point to a different place. And I don't know if they'll stay fresh. I mean, I'm not going to update them, but you know, they sort of, it's funny because I made this Tumblr page that looks very much like our old website, because it is our old website, just with different color scheme. And it's sort of the graveyard, you know, it's sort of the, Jamie's like, it's a museum, it's not a graveyard. and it's sort of, you know, it's the archives. Like, it's like, if you want to listen to our old shows, they're available, and we'll continue to, you know, I'll leave a little bit of money in the Destination DIY account to pay for hosting for, you know, the future years, which fortunately is, you know, cheap, and domains and stuff like that. So it won't be like it just disappears.
Please. Yes.
I think about that.
Archive.org, though, if you think it's going to disappear.
Yeah, right. And the Wayback Machine. I mean, it'll always be there. Like, nothing really goes away on the internet.
Well, if they have it.
Yeah, that's
you
true.
You do have to. There was a moment where I should have done a lot more work every day to make sure that they had every single episode of Free Speech Radio News.
Oh.
Like, the extra 15 minutes of work added on to my work day.
It's hard to do that.
Yeah, but if you don't send it to them, they don't have it.
Well, PRX also has it.
Okay, that's wonderful.
So a lot of our stuff is up on PRX. And sometimes it's like different versions of it. But anyway, it's up there. And, you know, so it'll live on the interwebs.
Well, Julie, I really appreciate you sharing the story with us. I wish we were having you on because the show was still going, but we only have had our show here now for 15 episodes. So the sort of time overlap has been minimal, although you and I met almost 2 years ago when you were doing your Indiegogo, I believe it was, before launching as the podcast. So we did get a chance to talk then, and I'm glad we did. But I really do appreciate you sharing the story because I think it's a positive story myself, because you accomplished a lot. Lots of people enjoyed it, and you're choosing how this goes, and you seem happy
right.
with your decision, and that in that your decision is about you mentioned it, and you said, because it'll give me the opportunity also to embrace new projects and new opportunities that may come on the horizon. And that's great to hear, that you're not like, screw this radio production nonsense. I mean, that instead, like, oh no, maybe now I'll have a chance to take on some of these projects I wasn't able to because everything was going here. And that's, yeah. I like hearing that.
Well, and I'm glad that I stopped doing it before I got to that point where I didn't enjoy the work anymore. Because, I mean, yeah. I've always enjoyed the work. You know, I was anxious about something unrelated to the show a few weeks ago, and I had some editing that I needed to do, and I sat down and I started editing, and I just forgot all about whatever it was I was worried about, because, you know, you just get into it.
Yeah.
And it's in your blood. Like, I mean, and it is really analogous to music. My husband and I talk about this a lot because he's a musician, and it's like, you have to make music. I have to do this, you know, like, that's just how I feel about it. And I think I don't want to discourage people from making their own podcasts. I don't want to sound like I'm down on that. I really think people should do this, you know, and they should find a way to make it work for them. And there are lots of different ways now to do that, you know, and there are ways to make a podcast. And sometimes a podcast isn't, you know, less production than, that it's less complicated than I made it.
Right. It is right here.
Yes, and it's a good podcast.
As you sit
and
here
people
in our,
listen
in our
to
home
it.
Studio.
Yeah.
Well, it reminds me of the distance between Paul F. Tompkins' original podcast, the Paul F. Tompcast, and his current one, Spontanea Nation, where it's the same length, and I imagine the Paul F. Tompcast took 50 hours to produce each episode, and the current one, Spontanea Nation, takes probably about 2 hours.
2 to 5, yeah. Probably, exactly.
And he has more listeners, and he has more fun.
So maybe, here's to hoping you find that next project or projects when you're ready. When you're ready to put the headphones back on.
Well, thank you so much. And I really appreciate you guys having me over to, really tell the whole story.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I was glad to hear it.
Yeah, thanks for coming in.
Yeah.
And there you have it, our lengthy interview with Julie Sabatier. I want to thank Julie so much again for coming in and sharing her story with us. This is Eric Klein coming to you in post-production land without Paul Riesemendahl with me. Just to say that I feel justified in airing on our podcast feed the entire interview, hardly a note trimmed from that interview, because Julie never rambled, and she told her entire story briefly, I would think, since it's a 9-year story, and it hits every theme that our podcast Radio Survivor our founding questions. You know, Paul and I sat down before we started recording together and wrote in a notebook some founding questions. What were we going to seek to answer by doing the work of recording this radio show, this podcast? And one of them was, why do it? And then the other one is, how do you do it? And I think Julie's story of why she did it and how she did it is really instructive. Gives me a lot of encouragement and hope and practical knowledge moving forward as a producer, as an independent producer. So thank you again, Julie. Thank you so much. And speaking of all that, you, our listener, if you appreciated that work, should visit Radio Survivor's Patreon page. Julie Sabatier, she spoke at length about crowdfunding a radio program. Paul, in his concern for the length of the interview, thought that maybe that was the section we could trim. I think it had to be left in because crowdfunding your independent radio program is the only thing that's on my mind always. And I imagine that if you're a radio producer at all, or if you're in love with one, crowdfunding a radio program, crowdfunding your podcast is something that's always in the back of your mind. Patreon.com/Radio Survivor is where this program is putting a nickel towards the crowdfunding work. And if you appreciate what we're doing, check it out. There'll be more. We'll get into greater detail about why you would do such a thing in a later broadcast. Up next, I'm so pleased to say, thank you for being patient, is Lasar's Letter on Radio.
This is Matthew Lasar with Lasar's Letter on Radio. According to the rules of anniversary journalism, the 76th birthday of anything isn't particularly significant. But this November 5th will mark the birthday of a radio event for which that number resonates. The premiere of the great baritone Paul Robeson singing the patriotic cantata Ballad for Americans on the CBS network.
In 76 the sky was red, thunder rumbling overhead, that King George couldn't sleep in his bed. And on that stormy morn, old Uncle Sam was born.
It was 1939. 2 months before the broadcast, Nazi troops invaded Poland, triggering what we now call World War II. A day before the performance, President Franklin Roosevelt signed a law letting the United States send weapons to England and France. No surprise, then, that this unabashedly patriotic choral piece found its way to the airwaves. Here's what you may find a little unsettling. Robeson and the man who composed the music, Earl Robinson, were both members of the Communist Party.
Old Sam put on a three-cornered hat, and in a Richmond church he sat, and Patrick Henry told him that, while America drew breath, it was liberty or death.
Why were commies producing love songs for Patrick Henry? Here's the simple version of a complicated story. Thanks to the crisis of the Great Depression, the American Communist Party was enjoying its heyday in American politics. But since Adolf Hitler's rise to power in Germany, Marxist-Leninists around the world had made a strategic decision to tacitly support governments that could be counted on to fight fascism, seen as the number one enemy of the Soviet Union. The American Communist Party muted that position after Soviet leader Joseph Stalin signed a strategic aggression pact with the Nazis. But many members of the party saw the deal as Stalin's attempt to buy time until an inevitable war broke out. Thus, during the so-called Popular Front period of the 1930s, American communists framed their ideology as 20th century Americanism.
They all believed in liberty in those days.
Nobody who was anybody believed it. Everybody who was anybody, they doubted it. Nobody had faith. Nobody. Nobody but Washington. Tom Paine, Benjamin Franklin, Chaim Solomon, Crispus Attucks, Lafayette.
Ballad for Americans was a jumble of contradictions. Here was an African-American radical singing a song of praise to George Washington, a slaveholder. Here was an oratorical cry for liberty coming from supporters of Joseph Stalin, who in 1939 had in fact killed more innocent people than Hitler. And yet it was a beautiful, stirring piece of music. The lyrics penned by John Latouche, who would later write great songs like Taking a Chance on Love. Ballad for Americans was subsequently recorded by Bing Crosby. In 1940, it was sung at the American Communist Party's National Convention and the Republican Party's National Convention. Heck, my mother used to sing it to me. This is Matthew Lasar for the Radio Survivor podcast, with a reminder to scholars everywhere, if you want to understand the complicated history of the mid-20th century, you'd better listen to the radio. Thanks for considering my words.
For I have always believed it, and I believe it now, and you'll know who I am.
Who are you?
America!
Matthew, thank you so much for that report. I love these history lessons. I love these sound-rich history lessons, and I look forward to each and every one. If you enjoyed today's program, again, check out the Patreon page for Radio Survivor. Drop us a line by sending us an email. Do you think it was a good idea to include an hour-long interview, a 100-minute-long interview on the ins and outs? We went deep into the weeds of independent radio production and podcasting. And you know what? I love the weeds. That's why I'm doing this podcast. But if I shouldn't have gone into the weeds and you want to tell me so, or if you are a fan of the weeds and you are happy to have been taken into them, please drop us a line, podcast@radiosurvivor.com. Record yourself speaking into your smartphone as a voice memo app and then email it to podcast@radiosurvivor.com, or tippy-tap, tip-tap, type out that text message to us. Let us know if we can read it on the air, because that's what we want to do. We want to share your thoughts with the listeners. But even if we can't, please send us a line. Let us know you're out there, because we are doing this to be heard, and we want to hear back from you. Well, that's enough from me, Eric Klein. Thank you so much to Paul Riesmandel for his work on today's podcast. Thank you to Matthew Lasar and to Jennifer Waits. Thank you to Julie Sabatier, and good luck with your next independent radio production work. I know it's going to be good, and I will be one of the thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people tuning in to check it out. I want to add that if everything goes according to plan, Paul, Jennifer, and Matthew are all going to be in the room together in San Francisco, or at least in the San Francisco Bay Area, for our next episode. Should be a really special event, a Radio Survivor special event, and I can't wait to hear what they come up with to talk about. I'm really looking forward to hearing that program, and I'll have my two cents. I'm going to produce a little something to tag along for the ride, but the real meat of that show is going to be the brain trust of the Radio Survivor team, all together for the first time on the history of this podcast, this radio program, and it should be a treat, a real treat. So looking forward to that. See you next week.